Victoria. I'm here with Captain George Ruffy. The date is July 28th, and we are in Victoria. Okay, maybe we should begin with where and when you were born.
I was born on the 3rd of February, 1922, in Wolfville, Nova Scotia, in Apples Valley.
What did your family do for a living?
My father was in the, between the two wars, was owner of a stockbroking outfit, which of course crashed during the Depression. And then he went into working for the federal government. Then when the war broke out, he went into the war again, or into the army. He was with King's Canadian Hussars between the two wars, and ended up as a colonel in charge of the King's Canadian Hussars Army Corps at Camp Aldershot, which is 12 miles from Wolfville. And in the First World War, he had been with the 85th Battalion, Nova Scotia Highlanders, and overseas with them. Was wounded in 1918 at Passchendaele, and was taken to the hospital eventually in England, where he met my mother, who was a VAD, the First World War Voluntary Aid Detachment. And they were married in Birmingham, England, her home, and came to Canada in 1919.
Is there any other family military background that you know of?
My uncle was a major in the Halifax Rifles, obviously in Halifax, Nova Scotia, and his two sons were in the armed forces during the Second World War. These were strictly wartime and non-permanent active militia, not regular.
When did you enter the militia?
I entered the militia at the age of 15, Camp Aldershot, Nova Scotia, first as a bugler one summer, the next summer as a batman for my father. And then the third summer I went down, as they say, down the lines and learned to be a soldier, fire a rifle and so on and so forth.
Were you a boy soldier?
Yes.
And what was your pay as a boy soldier?
Well, about 25 cents a day, I think, at that time.
How regularly would the militia meet, and what sort of training did you get?
They met mainly for summer camp, Camp Aldershot, for 3 weeks, sometimes 4 weeks. And most of the training was infantry-type training, how to fire a pistol, rifle, marching, and infantry-type schemes in Camp Aldershot. We didn't have any winter.
And you were describing the militia?
Yes, we didn't do any training in the winter, but some parts of it did, but I never did. And why now, I don't know. Can't remember.
Was the militia well equipped, or was it poorly funded?
No, very poorly funded. As a matter of fact, about two summers in a row in the mid-30s, the militia at Camp Aldershot were paid nothing. But they went anyway and did their training. And because they were called armored car, they took their cars and used the cars as armored cars, going all over the sandy fields of Camp Aldershot and probably ruining quite a few of them. Before that, they had horses because they were hussars before cavalry. But there seemed to be a great deal of confidence and willingness to go into the militia, whether they were paid or not, in those days.
What was the makeup of the militia, the officer to rank ratio? Roughly.
Oh, about 12 officers to 200 men, I think.
And was it a large militia? How many men were in it?
This particular one, there were about 200, I think, in the King's Canadian Hussars. There were other regiments in Aldershot at the same time.
And do you remember your uniform? Could you describe it?
Yes, the first uniform was breeches that looked like pantaloons, and you wore boots, of course, high boots, ankle boots rather, with putties right up to just below the knees. And they caused a lot of infections at times in some of the men.
Right.
And the jacket was very similar to the present day tunic, with buttons down the front. And shirt and tie. No, the shirt and tie was the dress uniform, but the I wore jackets that went right up to the neck with hooks. Very uncomfortable and very hot.
And on August 29th, 1939, you were called up?
Yes. The regiment was called up, and my father mobilized enough men to do guard duty on the reservoirs in the area, the armories, and railheads, and the camp itself.
Got all the shot?
Yes.
What was the accommodation like?
Well, I happened to be in the armory in Kentville, and we slept in the drill hall in double-decker metal bunk beds, so to speak. And we were mobilized on the 29th of August, as you said, and we were demobilized in December in order to reform the whole 14th Brigade, which was in western Nova Scotia, and the King's Canadian Hussars Armored Car was transferred to artillery. And so I went back to Wolfville and took some courses because we're demobilized. And then we were called up again in May 1941 as the 87th 88th Field Battery.
And you were still at Aldershot?
Yes.
What sort of training did you receive during this period?
Training there was mainly a drill and rifle practice, pistol practice, and parade square things, teaching the men how to deal with vehicles and guns, but we only had one gun. Then we went, we were given sufficient guns for a battery, 8 guns, and we went from there to Camp de Burt, and we did some training there, and then on to Tracadie, New Brunswick, and more training there. And in Tracadie, we actually fired the guns.
For the first time?
Yes, first time. It's quite a revelation, I must say.
Were you a private at this time?
No, I was a second lieutenant at this time.
You missed very much officer training.
Oh, I was given a rank because of the being in the militia for a certain period, and we didn't go into training at that particular time. It came later.
Were you anxious to go overseas?
Oh yes, very anxious. Too anxious, really. I bugged too many people to get over.
You thought your father could help you?
No. He was called up as well, and was a bit overage, so he went with the Veterans Guard of Canada.
And when did you finally go overseas?
I went overseas in September 1942 from Halifax. In the meantime, I'd been to officers' training school in Camp Borden and Camp Petawawa. In Petawawa, we did more training common to the Corps, artillery, where we learned how to use the 25-pounder, which was a new gun at this time, and the 18 25-pounder prior to that. And we were expected to know the 25-pounder by the time we reached overseas. So after the training was finished, I became an instructor in Camp Petawawa, and that's where I bugged the adjutant of the camp to get me into a draft going overseas, and finally he got fed up with me, I think, and put me on a draft. So we sailed from Halifax, September 1942, and arrived in Scotland 7 days later in Gourock, went by train from there down to Camp Borden, Ontario. Camp Borden in Sussex, and there were two artillery bases there, and I went to the field artillery base there and more training, and then we were asked what division we'd wish to go to.
You had a choice.
Yes, of division, not regiment.
Yeah.
So I went, I requested the 3rd Division because the 1st Division had been over there and they were well organized and well trained, 2nd Division the same, and the 3rd Division was newly over there, and I thought I would learn a lot more and fit in better by learning, and that happened. So I was stationed in Brighton, in Sussex.
Did you find you had to do a lot of catching up with the others who had been over there for some time?
No.
They were still fairly green.
Pretty much the same, yes.
And what did the training consist of? More of the same?
Mostly field training where we actually deployed the guns most of the time. Parade Square works, of course. A little bit of rifle and pistol training and mortar training and bazooka. Other anti-tank weapons, PF and so on. And but we also did a lot of deploying as artillery in fields, farmers' fields, and so on. And any destruction that happened was paid for by the Canadian government, eventually, perhaps.
And you were with the 14th Field Regiment, did we say that?
Yes, 14th Field Regiment, Royal Canadian Artillery, and I was in the 34th Battery. This regiment had, of course, as all of them, three batteries and a regimental headquarters. And our main equipment was 25 pounder, of course. And we used gun tractors that were made in the United States and Canada by Ford and Chev. And the other vehicles were British, and they had right-hand drive, whereas the North American vehicles had left-hand drive. So our drivers had to be very, very careful.
Well, how did the English and Canadians get along and all the other soldiers who were over there?
My experience was that our people got along very well. A great many of them married English girls with the consent of the families, as far as we know, most of them, all of whom had to request permission, of course, from the Canadian government, as well as the parents of the girls.
Didn't realize it was that complicated.
It was very complicated, because they would then receive an allowance, you see. And they had to make sure that the chap wasn't married back in Canada as well. In the odd case, apparently that happened, although I don't know of any specific cases. mind you, that can happen anywhere. But generally speaking, the civilian population of Britain was very, very happy to have us there, I think, and especially in our coast defense role to in case of invasion from France. And there were many occasions when they thought the Germans were actually coming, but apparently they were just exercises on the French coast, and they never did come. But we went to different spots in the south of England, right on the coast and inland, in defense positions.
Did you yourself feel that an invasion was possible?
Yes, we did think it was possible because we saw rather poor, we thought, defense system along the coast, although we didn't know really what was there until later on. We discovered that they even had, were able to spread oil over the water around the coastline and set it on fire to prevent landing.
Okay, let's talk about some of your highlights of your training period in England. What were the things that stand out in your memory?
Right. At this time, of course, I was a lieutenant. I remember in particular going on a course in Camp Borden again, which was a wireless training course. We had to take Morse code. Now, I'd had Morse code in Boy Scouts, and I'd forgotten it completely, so I learned it all over again, and very slowly, I must say. And we learned how to operate different wireless sets, mobile sets and stationary sets that were normally in vehicles. And this certainly was very well run and an excellent course. And another course at Camp Borden was called a Command Post Officer's Course, where you were trained how to do surveying work, to survey your guns in gun positions, and to plot on an artillery board the target, and then what type of, what the line, range, and angle of sight should be, the angles, of course, to lay the guns and fire so that we could hopefully hit the target.
Could you choose your courses, or were they chosen for you?
No, they were chosen for us. We could ask, but they usually were filled up already by those that were chosen. And it was, they were chosen primarily because each person had to have the same type of training in order to do that particular job, and besides having refresher courses. We also had courses in aircraft recognition. Then we had to go back to the to our men and teach them the same thing. And we had model aircraft of our own planes, Allied planes and enemy planes, and also silhouettes. And I can remember when we were stationed in Christchurch and near Bournemouth, I was teaching the men aircraft recognition in a bandstand on a waterfront, very pleasant spot, and I was teaching them about a typhoon, and a typhoon happened to go over, so I pointed and said, "Now what is that?" And they didn't know. So I thought, well, I guess I'm not teaching properly. So we changed our tactics.
What were some of the other experiences you remember? You were on Exercise Spartan?
So on Exercise Spartan and one called Welsh. Exercise Spartan was an exercise that had 2 million troops, Americans, British, Canadian, French, Czech, you name it, all the different Allied forces that were stationed in Britain at the time waiting to invade Italy and Northwest Europe. And it started in the south of England, very near the coast, and worked up towards London, but not, didn't go into London, and then went west as far as, a little further than Oxford. I remember we stopped in a place called Fenny Stratford, which we thought was a rather charming name. And one particular place, we were always told to dig in our guns, same as we would in action. And we stopped on a golf course. I was given a golf course to deploy my troop, a beautiful golf course in Oxford. But I absolutely refused to dig up the golf course. It was such a beautiful golf course, and I'm sure we would have had the whole population against us. So I had the men line out with stakes where they would have dug, where they would have put their slip trenches, where their ammunition pits would have been, etc. And nobody came around to check, so we left the golf course in pretty good shape, I think.
What did you think of Spartan as a whole?
I thought it was a very excellent exercise. It had, it was a very hot time of year, which gave us, especially those who were going off to Italy eventually, gave them a darn good idea in North Africa of what working in the heat would be like. It also had very cold nights at times, so we knew what it would be like with our guns for cooler weather, although it wasn't really that cold. But all in all, the training value was far better than smaller exercises that we had, because we had to follow the complete routine, and we were watched very closely by umpires and told our errors right on the spot. So the next move, we would try not to make those same mistakes. When we went on Exercise Welsh, we did exercises part of the way to Wales, and then drove on to Brecon and a camp called Sennybridge. And there we did a lot of fire and movement, actually firing the guns and deploying. We had not done any firing on Spartan. This was excellent training, especially for map reading, because there were no landmarks anywhere. No churches, no buildings, just slight rises in the ground and a few copses of trees and so on. So it made map spotting and actually surveying the guns in very, very difficult, which was excellent training, because we ran up against some of this in Northwest Europe eventually. Not quite so difficult, really, but reminded of us of it later. And we had excellent firing there. The the civilian population were very, very good to us. When the boys had time off, went into the local pubs, they couldn't buy the first round. It was given to them. But I imagine they had more than one round. On the way back from Wales, we went to Lark Hill in Salisbury Plains, not far from Stonehenge, and we did fire and movement there, and fired the largest number of guns ever fired in peacetime.
Exactly, peacetime.
Yeah, in peacetime, in a sense.
Action, yeah.
Yeah. In any one spot, I think in the British Commonwealth, there were over 1,000 guns firing. And I remember our guns became very hot, and we had to spell them off. Otherwise, the lands and grooves wear down so quickly that you'd have to have new barrels. But it was a very good experience, and we, at this time, had, the first time, had fitted muzzle brakes, as they called them, to the 25-pounders to check the recoil of the gun so it wouldn't come back quite so far. It was less danger to the crew. So that worked out very well.
And after Salisbury Plains, where did you?
From Salisbury Plains, we went back to a new camp at Five Oaks near Horsham. And there we did a few deployment schemes with our guns, but no more firing. And from there we moved to we went up to Scotland, and we're really what you might call guinea pigs for the invasion of France. The 3rd Division was chosen to test all kinds of equipment to be used on D-Day. Yes, combined operations training. When we arrived in Scotland, we went to Toward Castle, T-O-W-A-R-D, they pronounce it Toward. It's on the Clyde River near in Allen, and we did combined ops training there by lashing our 25-pounders to the deck of LCT Mark IV ships that were going to be used to land troops on D-Day, to land guns and tanks and half-tracks and so on. And we did this for about 2 weeks and improved our ability to fire on rough water and smooth water, actually firing on a point, I think it was called Strone Point, a point of land that had been evacuated completely by civilians, of course. And the firing was reasonably accurate.
How do you get it accurate when you're going up and down in the...
Good question. Well, we were told that when the ship came down to fire, as it came down, so the ship was pretty well level then, and we had the range, the initial range from the target, or from the land, was given to us by the Navy, and we'd set a clock that ticked off hundreds of yards. And by this time, we were still using degrees and minutes, and yards and feet and so on. So we would give the range to the guns, and when the clock came around to a particular distance from the target, we would yell fire, and they wouldn't fire until the ship had become level. So it was quite an experience, and really not enough though for D-Day, because it was terribly rough then, far more rough than that training. Another part of the training there was combined operations training. For some reason I was chosen to go with some commandos on a submarine at Rothsay on the Isle of Bute. It was a submarine Oberon, very large submarine, and there were 28 North Nova Scotia Highlanders trained as commandos, 3 engineers from the British Army, and a combined operations trained Englishman who knew about guns as well. I was supposed to go as an expert on guns, and we were supposed to land on D-Day and go ashore, and I was to tell the commanders were to capture coast defense guns. I was to tell them what type of gun it was, and the engineers would realize how much explosive they needed and blow it up. Theoretically speaking, of course. And we did this training by going aboard about midnight, having a sumptuous meal of even bananas and oranges, steaks, and other things. And then at 3 a.m. we would, with blackened faces, and everything that was light was covered with black, and we went, got off the submarine. We'd been submerged and gone up the Clyde River a bit, And we go ashore in our rubber dinghy and capture a coast defense gun there, which was held by the British, of course, British troops, and pretend to blow it up and so on and so forth. Fortunately, they scrapped the idea because if we had gone in about 4 o'clock in the morning, and we would have been blown up, of course, because there were mines at low tide and you couldn't go over it. The tide was coming in when the actual invasion happened, you see. So they canceled that, and we finished our training there and moved to Christchurch, which really was an excellent posting. The civilian population had heard about the 1st Division when they got in trouble in Camp Aldershot in England, and with having a bit of a riot. So they were told, all their young daughters, not to have anything to do with the Canadians. So they were, we saw them as we drove in, and they were walking into shops or turning their daughters' faces away from us and so on. And but within 3 days, the whole population was inviting any of us to their homes and introducing their daughters and heaven knows what else. And many of our chaps married Christchurch girls in the long run. And it was there that we did our training out in the New Forest area, not far away between there and Southampton. And we were issued with 105 millimeter guns mounted on self-propelled Sherman chassis called Priests. And we were to use those for the invasion. Of course, by this time, we still didn't know where we were going. And everybody had to be retrained to use the metric system, because 105 is strictly metric. And we had to retrain all our driver operators, because the driver operators had to be prepared to drive the tanks. We had to, our driver mechanics and our regular drivers all had to be retrained as well. And this was no problem, though. It's just a matter of time. And at this particular time, we had 3 Russian officers, artillery officers, posted to us. And I still don't know today why. They brought their own vodka and a lot of their Russian-type food, never became friendly with us, hardly ever spoke to us, and just watched what we did and made notes, and then they left. I still have never found out why. But that's too bad, because we would like very much to discuss their artillery with us, about ours. While we were there, we had a very bad accident. One of our tanks came around a corner and the track slewed on the pavement and went into, hit a gas lamp post. The gas lights were not used, but the gas was still there. So the gas was escaping and the tank went straight on and smashed into a grocery store window. Nobody was hurt, fortunately. But it took a while to turn the gas off. Another one was going over a bridge over the Avon River, which runs right through Christchurch. There are 2 bridges in a row, and one is curved. And one of our tanks was going over on the right-hand side of the road, of course. No, on the left-hand side of the road. And a bus came over the bridge at the same time, and there's a turret on the right-hand side of our self-propelled tank, self-propelled gun, and that pushed all the windows in the bus, and it was a school bus, little children in it. But only one child was cut a little bit in the leg. He's wearing shorts. So I stopped to investigate the accident and got our medical officer, and he looked at the boy and said he was okay and, you know, cleaned it out and bandaged him. And then I took him to the school. The school told him who he was, where his family lived, and I drove him home. Went into the mother, and the first thing the mother said, "Oh, won't you come in and have a nice cup of tea?" Which I did. And we chatted about the boy, and then she said, "Would you mind taking him back to school?" Which I did. So they're very pleasant and trusted us implicitly, I guess.
Were you anxiously awaiting the invasion?
Yes, we were very anxious to get into action and get the war over with. Not as anxious, perhaps, as the 1st and 2nd Divisions, because they'd been there much longer than we had. But they did, of course, go into Italy, and our 1st Division did, 1st and 5th. And the first, second, the second, third, and fourth went into France eventually. From Christchurch, from Christchurch, we did our final training and were issued with all kinds of equipment, doing a lot of exercises from landing craft just to go out into the water and then land to prove the waterproofing of our vehicles. We had Bren gun carriers, and they were waterproofed up to what they call a splash of 6 feet, so that when you're sitting down, the only person inside who could see was the driver through a small slit. If you stood up, you could look over. And this was because we expected to land off the LCT in fairly deep water, 3 to 4 feet at least, and then going down the ramp, the water would be higher in the front. And the same with the tanks. They were waterproofed, so they could, the engines were waterproofed on all these vehicles, so that, but you couldn't drive them for any distance afterward because the engine would heat up. So they had to stop and rip off all this waterproofing and go on, eventually. In other words, you couldn't drive for about 10 miles. Nor, we couldn't very well anyway because the enemy were there. But we practiced that, and we also had to provide our old 25-pounder at one stage to practice loading on a coal boat in Poole Harbor, see how many they could get on board this just for transporting equipment. And when the guns came back, and the men, I wasn't on that particular one, they were completely black with coal dust and the guns and everything. They weren't very happy, I must say. But anyway, that's the minor detail. In the meantime, I was sent out as an umpire on an exercise with the 2nd Division, and the first night I was there, I started getting terrible pains in my right finger here, which I remembered cutting on the LCT up in Scotland, and an infection had come in. So I went to an MO out in the field, and he cut it open, squeezed out a green core, and said, "Go back to your unit, you're going to have blood poisoning." And he said, "It'll probably go up your arm." By the time I got back to the unit, the rear party, sure enough, there was a red line up my arm. So I went to the doctor, and he gave me a hot water bottle, and I had to hold it under my arm every day for an hour, and eventually it was all right. But these little things, it's amazing how they happen, and how fortunate we were to have medical people available anywhere. Each regiment has its own medical officer, and their own padres too, for the other purpose.
Did you continue on with training and preparation for the invasion?
Yes, and once that was...